current state on 90.5 WKAR. It's Monday. We're glad you're here, the 7th of October. I wish I had a dollar for every time this has happened, but I finally caught my first episode of Low Winter Sun last night on AMC, and it was the season finale. This has a tendency to happen. I just do not plan my TV viewing as carefully as I should. So now I'm left to watch the previous episodes online or whatever. Very intense, very dark, but really quite well done at the same time. If you don't have an appetite for the dark and the bleak, it may not be for you. But it is really well done, I think. A police drama set in Detroit, as you may know. So there's this visual dimension that you're constantly trying to spot some landmark or someplace you're familiar with. So I will be ready for the second season, I promise. If AMC decides to create a second season, I'm under the impression that they will figure that out soon. Coming up, we look at Michigan weather. The Michigan Historical Museum has an exhibit on Michigan weather. It's called Lake Effects, quite appropriately. And there's a new virus that's been discovered in Michigan that attacks dogs. We'll talk with Dr. Tom Mullaney of Michigan State University about that. At the top of the program, across the nation, more and more people who are suffering from a severe mental illness are likely to wind up in prison than in a treatment facility. Here in Michigan, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, estimates that more than four times the number of people with mental illnesses are in prisons than in hospitals. Our next guest has been an outspoken advocate against this trend and incarcerating mentally ill people. Pete Early is a journalist, advocate, and author of 13 books, including Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness, which was a finalist for the 2007 Pulitzer Prize. He'll be speaking in East Lansing this Wednesday at the invitation of the NAMI Lansing chapter. We've invited him to join us by phone today. Welcome to the program, Pete.
Thank you so much for having me on.
In your book, which goes back to 2006, you described how our jails and prisons have essentially become asylums for many people suffering with severe mental illnesses. How much has changed? Has it gotten better?
No, actually, it's gotten worse, and it continues to get worse. My son had a breakdown while he was in college. Okay, if he had lived in Michigan, the chances of someone who has a breakdown like he did ending up in jail rather than getting treatment, according to a recent study, in Michigan are 4-1 in favor you'll end up in jail rather than getting any kind of help. 4-1. Now imagine if that was true about heart attacks, saying if you have a heart attack, 4-1 chances you'll be. And if you look at, I'm not an expert on Michigan, but I did pull some numbers, and you're absolutely right. Your jails and prisons are the largest mental facilities in your state. You have about 8,500 people with serious mental illnesses in your jails and prisons. You have 781 in your hospitals.
I imagine some states are better than others nationally across the country. Do you see anything encouraging in terms of particular states?
Well, one of the things that Michigan's doing that's really great, and your legislator just did some of this, is they're looking at mental health courts. You know, this is not only the right thing to do. We're not talking about Hannibal Lecter serial killers. We're talking about people who have schizophrenia, people who used to be in state hospitals, which we've closed down. And it's not only right to help them and get them out of jails because they don't get help there. It makes sense economically. You know, in Michigan, it costs about $34,000 a year to keep someone in your jails and prisons. For half that, you could have them in the community with what's called an assertive community treatment program, which has a group of experts who actually come out and talk to them, make sure they're doing okay, and housing first. So you could be saving millions of dollars by doing the right thing. And one of the things your legislature's done is set up more mental health courts. So people like my son, my son broke into a house to take a bubble bath. Okay, luckily no one was there. He was charged with two felonies. He didn't need to go through the normal court system and not get any treatment and languish in jail. He needed to be put into a treatment system as opposed to just sitting in jail. And that's what mental health courts do. And your state's doing some good work that way.
You've argued for going back to expanding the state mental hospital system. Why so?
Well, I don't really argue. Nobody wants to go back to what we had. That's ridiculous. We want people to live in the community. But how and where are these people living in our communities? Most of them are living in real substandard boarding homes, nursing homes, or they're homeless or they're in jail. So we haven't improved their lives by closing down the hospitals like you did. I mean, you closed down 12 of your 16 state hospitals between 87 and 2003, and then you cut $50 million for your mental health services. So you don't have the money to help people in the community. But there are people who are severely ill who need a place to go to get stabilized. I'm not talking about permanent institutions. I'm talking about being able to go longer than, in Virginia, the average stay in a state hospital is 5 days. That's not long enough. You need time to get well. And so I'm talking about having hospital beds available. You know, they did a national study, and they said that in most communities you need, for every 100,000 people, you should have 50 beds. Michigan was six from the bottom. It had 10 beds. So there is no place for people to go. So somebody like my son, he needs help, he needs emergency crisis care, and it can take hours and sometimes days to find some place to have them go to be stabilized. And then as soon as they're in there, the insurance companies and everybody want them out. So it's just a really messed up system.
But you maintain that there are financial paybacks to expanding investment in mental health. I'm trying to envision an encounter between you and a critic of runaway government spending. You would maintain that over the longer haul, we actually save money by investing more in mental health, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll take that argument anytime, because what's happening is you're spending $34,000 a year on somebody who needs treatment, who's going to be released back in the community. You know, when I did my book in Miami, we had cases where people were picked up and put in that jail 10, 11 times a year because they were charged as misdemeanors. They're held for 2 or 3 weeks, then they're turned loose. Those people, there's the famous story, Million Dollar Murray, where a person in New York cost the city $1 million per year and he wasn't getting any treatment. The ones in Miami who were homeless on the streets, who were psychotic, who were going in and out of jail, were costing $60,000 a year. So the point is, these people are costing you money, and they're not getting any better. So why not take that $34,000 a year you're spending on them in jail right now, take that money, cut it in half, and give them an ACT team, which is intensive treatment, and housing first, give them a place to live. You'll save half that money, and you'll actually help people. I mean, I pulled some numbers off of newspaper articles, and you know, the mental health courts in Michigan said that they were the cost to helping someone get treatment down there was $4,000 a year compared to $34,000. And mental health courts have an 80% success rate. So, I mean, it's illogical to argue that by helping people with these services that you're going to, you know, cost more money. You're going to save money in the long run.
Pete Early is our guest. He's a journalist and author of 13 books and a mental health advocate, an advocate for greater investment in helping the mentally ill. Turning to the Affordable Care Act here, Pete, what's your assessment of mental health coverage with regard to the ACA?
It should make it more available to people who are not getting treatment and do not have any coverage. And the problem is we're talking about, when it comes to that, a larger area than just the homeless and the severely mentally ill. We're talking about people like my son who are the working poor who can't afford insurance coverage. So it should help those folks get better services.
I take it, though, the details involved here are still not nailed down. They're still pretty vague.
Absolutely. Okay. But that's how Washington works, and that's why it's so you had to keep your eye on these things, because what the legislators do, what your members of Congress do, is they pass this grand plan, and then they turn it over to the federal workers to actually figure out how to implement it. And that's where you get it gets extremely complicated and gets detailed. And with health care, especially mental health care, that's where the tire meets the road, and it's really difficult sometimes to avoid some real problems. And I mean, look, when I did my book in Miami at the jail there, you would have people who would come in on medications, and these medications were very sensitive, but then the rules would say, okay, we're only going to pay for a different medication that's cheaper. And so they'd take them off their medication, and then they'd get in trouble. And these are the kind of, you know, details that still have to be worked out to make sure that people don't fall through the cracks.
What are your biggest concerns here? Does the government shutdown scenario, does the upcoming debt ceiling showdown, does that impact this discussion?
Oh, of course. I mean, the thing about people with mental illnesses and why your legislators cut $50 million is they have no one who represents them. They don't have any voting bloc. Nobody marches down the street saying, join us, we're a group of schizophrenics, you know, that we have schizophrenia and we want to be part of the bipolar club. And we have no PAC money. We don't give money to politicians. So the only way that we can get a seat at the table is by going in and saying, look, you're changing this system from a healthcare system into a criminal justice one. Our jails and prisons are swarming with people because they aren't getting services. You ask me what my biggest fear is? My biggest fear is that you have a lot of responsible sheriffs and law enforcement people there who say, look, you can't treat people this way. We got to give them help. And so they build a better mental health care system in your jails and prisons. And they build facilities in your jails and prisons to help people. And that sounds good, but it's wrong, because you shouldn't have to get arrested in order to get decent mental health care. We're talking about people who get sick. And why should you go to jail to get help if you get sick? And that's what we do in this country.
Pete Early has been our guest. He's a former Washington Post reporter, a mental health advocate, and author of the 2007 book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Pete will be speaking this Wednesday at the Hanna Community Center here in East Lansing at 7 p.m. Thanks for joining us, Pete Early. Good luck.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Dog owners in Michigan have a new reason to keep an eye on their pets. Last week, Michigan State University clinicians announced the arrival in Michigan of a virus that can make dogs sick. The canine circovirus was first identified in California just last April. MSU's Diagnostic Center for Population and Animal Health, DCPAH, identified it in two animals that died, although veterinarians say dog owners shouldn't panic because they were also infected with other organisms which more likely led to their demise. Still, it's the first time the recently identified virus has been found here in Michigan, and here to tell us more is Dr. Tom Mullaney of MSU's Diagnostic Center for Population and Animal Health. Dr. Mullaney, welcome.
Good morning.
What does circovirus do to a dog?
Well, to understand the circovirus story, you go back to just last year, 2012, and there was the first report in the scientific literature of a canine circovirus published in the Journal of Virology.
Mm-hmm.
And in that report, no disease was associated with that virus.
Mm.
Then forward to April of 2013, just like you said, there was a closely related dog circovirus was described in emerging infectious disease in dogs in California. And that virus was found in the feces of 11% of dogs with diarrhea in their study, and in 7% of healthy dogs. It was also found in the blood of 3% of dogs with fever of unknown origin, and those dogs also had low white blood cell counts and low platelet counts. Now, to put it in perspective, 70% of the dogs from the study in California that had diarrhea and circovirus also were infected with other pathogenic agents that we know cause disease in dogs.
Okay.
Okay? So the conclusion that they drew was that circovirus alone or in combination with other agents might contribute to illness and death in dogs.
Is this changing, though? Is this a virus that is, that it, I mean, we hear about mutating viruses. Does this virus have the capacity to mutate? And
yes.
I mean, it's not necessarily, as you say, it's found in a lot of healthy dogs as well. What is this a puzzle that we're just waiting to see kind of evolve into something else, or what?
Yes, to a degree it is. But in order to maybe get an idea, we do know a lot about another circovirus, and that is pig circovirus.
Mm.
Okay, pig circovirus occurs in pigs worldwide, and it's a disease that has been very well studied. There are actually two circoviruses in pigs, And circovirus 2 is the one that's associated with disease in pigs. But again, it seems to be that pigs are more likely to develop severe disease when they are co-infected with several other pathogenic microorganisms.
Okay.
So again, it's one of those diseases that it potentially could cause disease on its own, but in combination with other infectious agents that may have some effects on the immune system.
It's a lot worse.
Then you're going to get a syndrome of clinical signs that could result in death.
How should dog owners respond to this? How should the veterinary community respond to this?
Well, the way I think they're responding right now is they're getting calls from their clients that own dogs, concerned. When sick dogs are taken to a veterinary hospital, particularly dogs that are showing evidence of vomiting and diarrhea, I'm sure the topic of possible circovirus comes up. However, in those cases, I think it's very important that a thorough clinical workup, laboratory diagnostic workup be done to investigate and identify all the common causes of vomiting and diarrhea. And there are many of them. There are both viruses, bacteria, and other agents that cause vomiting and diarrhea in dogs. All of those agents should be investigated as possible causes. And then, of course, because of the emergence of this virus, the possibility of circovirus playing a role should be considered. At this point in time, I want to emphasize that that role has not been clearly identified. It's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that healthy dogs have this virus, and what we're trying to determine is what role might it be playing in a certain percentage of cases with those clinical signs that I just mentioned.
Do veterinarians, when a dog exhibits these symptoms and ends up in a veterinarian's office, do veterinarians typically test for the circovirus or not?
Well, keep in mind that this is very, very new. There was no test available for circovirus until this paper came out from California in April of this year.
Mm.
And then following that paper, people in laboratories just like ours began to ask ourselves, is this something that we should develop a test? Because looking towards the future, it was something we felt, well, our clients are probably going to start asking to have this done.
Yeah.
And the story on dog circovirus really escalated when a certain number of dogs in Ohio were reported to possibly being affected with this virus. And then that became a kind of a national story, because now you had the description of the scientific article from California. Now you had the possibility that it was occurring in Ohio. And so there was a lot of media releases related to that possibility. And as far as I know, they are actually still investigating the possible cause of those dog deaths in Ohio. I don't think a definitive answer has been reached yet. And during all of this, individuals in our laboratory were working on developing a test. So we have now a PCR test to detect the circovirus either in the tissues or in the feces of dogs. But just detecting it is not good enough because, as I've already mentioned, it can be found in the feces of normal dogs as well as dogs that have diarrhea.
Mm.
So we are going to take this one step further with a further test called in situ hybridization. And this is where we will use RNA and DNA probes, okay, to specifically locate the virus in pathologic or microscopic lesions that we're seeing. And that test is under development right now in our laboratory, and we should have it up and running in probably 2 to 3 weeks. And I'm a little bit hesitant to be more definitive than that, because when we first start using these probes, they may not work. In that case, we have to go back to the drawing board, and it may take, you know, a few extra weeks to get this up and running. That will give us a much better idea as to whether or not circovirus is actually playing a role in the disease and deaths of the dogs where we have already said we have identified the virus.
Very interesting. There has been some reporting saying that the circovirus can also be contracted by humans. Is that accurate?
I believe it's not accurate. I've looked in the literature for evidence of circovirus in people, and I can find no evidence that circoviruses have been described as causing illnesses in people. Also, I have the feeling that if there were concerns that people were infected with Zika virus, that I'm quite certain that the Michigan Department of Community Health Laboratories would be investigating this, and I'm also quite certain that the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta would be investigating this. And as of today, I am unaware of any ongoing investigations in those arenas.
Okay, but is it a topic of discussion in your community at all?
It is a topic of discussion, and the answer at this point in time is that we see no evidence, no clear scientific evidence that this particular virus is causing illness in people.
Hollywood might have us believe that something like this happens regularly, a virus appearing someplace it has never appeared before. Does this happen more often than we might be led to believe?
Yes, this happens. There's no doubt about it. And people in my line of work, this is something that we're constantly trying to find. We're trying to look for new patterns of disease. We're trying to identify new viruses or new infectious agents that may be caused with disease. And, in fact, our residents and our faculty members in the laboratory, this is one of the things that literally, one of the things that brings them to work every day, the possibility that they might identify something that's novel.
Very interesting. Our guest has been Dr. Tom Mullaney of MSU's Diagnostic Center for Population and Animal Health, talking about the newly identified dog Zika virus, newly identified here in Michigan. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. At the Michigan Historical Museum in Lansing, a new exhibit called Lake Effects examines the state's weather history, including the state's worst natural disasters. Displays show how the people of Michigan have dealt with the vagaries of all four seasons and the evolution of how people have predicted weather. Current state Scott Pohl toured the exhibit with the museum's chief curator, Maria Quinlan Leiby. She's wanted to devote an exhibit to the weather for a long time.
We've been thinking a lot about doing things that are a little more interdisciplinary, and we're going to have some very interesting programming, especially, that goes along with this exhibit. It is aimed at kids. It's also really aimed at families, because I think that families, when they look at especially the different seasonal displays, will find things to talk about, and parents and grandparents can relate experiences from their lives to their kids.
Well, this is certainly eye-catching, this enormous orange, I'm not sure what you would call it. It looks like a bodysuit or something that you would wear in the water that's incredibly cold. Am I right about that?
You are exactly right. It's a cold water survival suit, and vessels on the Great Lakes carry these for all their crew now. They're oversized so that they can get into them quickly if they need to. They have waterproof zippers and special closures at the neck so that water really can't get in.
Is there a flotation element to this design?
There is. The suits themselves are buoyant, but there's a tube coming over the mannequin's shoulder, and there's a flotation bladder on his back that he can inflate.
Well, I want one of these if I go overboard on Lake Superior.
Yeah, you wouldn't survive without it.
Here's a display that focuses on the Great Storm of 1913. Let's start with some background on the storm of 1913.
It's still regarded as the most destructive storm on the Great Lakes. It took place over several days and ended with massive destruction, especially in Lake Huron, where 8 freighters sank with all hands. There was a lot of storm damage along the coasts. One of the photographs we have shows the wreckage from a boathouse at the Point of Barks life-saving station on the Thumb. But all along the lakes, buildings that were close to the shore were flooded, damaged, destroyed.
Here's a Detroit News front page that says the headline, "Death Total on Lakes May Be 273, Greatest Mystery in History of Great Lakes Disasters," and it's dated November 13th, 1913. And there also are some artifacts from the wreck of a boat called the Regina in 1913. Tell me about these artifacts.
These were brought up after the wreck was discovered in the 1980s. The Regina was a package freighter carrying a very miscellaneous cargo. Most of the artifacts that we have, though, were being used by the crew. The Regina was one of the freighters on Lake Huron. It went down near Port Sanilac and is still on the bottom there.
Then we also have a case that has some items that were recovered from the Rockaway, which sank off South Haven in a storm in 1891.
Like so many other ships over the years, the Rockaway encountered a violent storm in November. In this case, all the crew were rescued, but the ship went down and stayed there till the 1980s when some fishermen snagged their anchor on the wreck. And because it was close to the Lake Michigan Maritime Museum, a full archaeological study was done on the vessel, giving historians a lot of information about how working schooners operated on the lakes, how they were built, those kinds of things.
Here's a display that has to do with heat in the summer and some of the hottest days in Michigan, and it reflects that 1936 was the hottest summer ever recorded in the United States, and considering how hot it's been the last few summers, some people might find that to be surprising.
It was a surprise to the staff.
There's a graph that shows high temperatures for days between July 8th and July 14th of 1936. The top temperature recorded in Lansing was 101 degrees, but there are a couple of 108 degree readings in Grand Rapids and Flint.
Yes. I don't know how Lansing got off so lucky. But part of what made it really bad was the sustained heat. If you follow a couple of the lines, especially Flint and Detroit, they were 100 or higher for all those days, all 7 days.
Even 104 one day in Traverse City.
Yes, but being on the lake, they weren't over 100 for more than 2 days in a row.
Well, the real thing to notice there is that it was 104 degrees in Traverse City on July 13th, 1936. The next day, the high was 76. That's quite a difference in a one-day span.
It is indeed, and I'm sure it was welcome.
Well, not to make light of the situation, though, that was deadly heat in those days. One of the newspaper headlines around this display, the Grand Rapids Herald, 112 die as mercury mounts. This was deadly in those days.
Yes, yes. It was about 500 people, I believe, in the state of Michigan. Most of them in the Detroit area died from heat-related causes.
There's also, sadly, an exhibit about the awful tornado that struck Beecher in the Flint area in 1953 with 116 deaths. And next to that is an exhibit regarding flooding in Michigan with a very interesting picture in the background of which you can see the MSC, as it was at the time, tower on the Michigan State University campus. Let's talk first of all about the tornado of 1953.
Okay. Tornado warning in the early 50s was in its infancy, and the reason there was so much devastation, so much of a human toll, is that there just wasn't much warning. The tornado was half a mile wide at times. It was a F5 tornado, very powerful and absolutely terrifying to the people who lived through it.
you have an aerial photo where it's easy to see the path of destruction that the tornado created.
Yeah, yeah. And it happened after 8 o'clock at night. So and even though it was June, there wasn't a whole lot of daylight left, which is why you see in one of the photos people searching in the dark. They were trying to find anybody who might be alive in the remains.
Now, the flooding exhibit includes photographs from a big flood in this area in 1947. It includes the photo I mentioned earlier, the flooding photo with the MSC smokestack tower in the background, and also an interesting map of the city of East Lansing and Lansing, which indicates in red how extensively the Red Cedar River and the Grand River overflowed their banks in this flood.
Yes, they mapped it because they realized they'd had floods in the same places before. 1904 in particular, in downtown Lansing at Kalamazoo and River Streets. And after the 47 flood, they decided they wanted to see if they could do something to prevent future flooding. So they needed to map the areas that were inundated and take a look at the engineering and what they would have to do.
All right, now one thing I want to ask you about is that when people hear that at least a part of the display has to do with disasters, that tends to attract people. Tell people there's an exhibit about the weather, and for some people that will be interesting, but for others it's the fact that there's information and artifacts from shipwrecks here, that sort of thing. This kind of combines the appeal for both, doesn't it? An interest in the weather and an interest in natural disasters.
I hope so. We wanted to be sure and include the 1913 storm because its centennial is coming up just next month, and to remind people that weather is both good and bad in terms of its effects on us, and we have to deal with all of that.
Maria Quinlan Leiby is the chief curator at the Michigan Historical Museum. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that is our show for today. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, Ontario Power Generation plans to store 200,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste in an underground cavern near Lake Huron. The storage site location has raised concerns across the Great Lakes Basin. State Senator Hoon-Young Hopgood traveled to Canada last week to address the potential threats the site poses to Michigan. We hear more about his trip and his discussions tomorrow. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth's our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry and to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.